Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. Preparing for a scientific conference on using radio astronomy to search for extraterrestrial civilizations in 1961, astronomer Frank Drake wrote out a simple equation to try and organize the topics to cover in a systematic way, from the number of stars in our galaxy to habitable planets and the lifetimes of civilizations. It's called the Drake Equation, and here in 2024, it's become an even more important and fascinating tool for investigating one of the greatest questions of all time: are we alone in the universe? Over the next two episodes, we're going to break down all the parts of the Drake Equation, and don't worry, no math will be required on your part. Our guide for this exploration and my special co-host will be Bill Diamond, President and CEO for the SETI Institute, a nonprofit scientific organization dedicated to the search for extraterrestrial intelligence specifically and life beyond Earth in general. Later on in the show, we'll be joined by SETI Institute scientists Uma Gordy, Doug Caldwell, and Natalie Cabral to explore the first terms in the Drake Equation and what we now know compared to when the equation was first developed in 1961. But first, I'm joined by my friend and co-host Bill Diamond, President and CEO of the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California, to talk about the history of the famous equation and break down the basics of its seven terms that theoretically, when multiplied together, will arrive at N, the number of other civilizations out there that we could potentially detect. Bill Diamond, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Well, we're here to do a special program, two parts, on the famous Drake Equation. And so I'd kind of like you to help introduce us to the Drake Equation. First of all, let's talk about its historical context. Who was Frank Drake? Why is he important to SETI? And when did he write this equation?
Sure. Well, Frank Drake was a radio astronomer who had just received his PhD from Harvard University and had done his undergraduate work at Cornell. And he was inspired, I think, by the famous paper of 1959 by astronomers Kokoni and Morrison, also from Cornell, to conduct what they had just surmised in their paper might be an interesting experiment, which is to listen to the skies with radio telescopes on the notion that other technological civilizations having risen elsewhere in our galaxy might be leveraging technologies in much the same way we do, or might be leveraging things in nature like the electromagnetic spectrum in ways that we do, and therefore might be detectable from even great distances. So in 1960, he conducted the first experiment to use radio telescopes to search the skies for signs of technology as a proxy for life and intelligence elsewhere in the universe. And this was conducted at the then fairly new Green Bank Observatory of the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, or NRAO. And about a year later, it was the National Academy of Sciences, and especially the Space Science Board, that was curious about SETI as an endeavor and whether or not there was a scientific case to be made for conducting SETI experiments. And so they actually reached out to a gentleman named J.P.T. Pearman, who was actually a ballistics expert of all things and a scientist. But they asked him to put together a meeting of relevant sort of specialists and scholars to discuss whether or not there was a scientific merit, rather, to the notion for searching for extraterrestrial intelligence. And so there was a gathering that took place in 1961 with 10 scientists, including Pearman. Frank Drake was there. John Lilly, who's a physician studying communications, was there.
Famously studied dolphin communications.
Dolphin communications, which is why the gathering of these individuals became known as the Order of the Dolphin, because of Lilly's work on studying dolphin communications and vocalizations. There was also an eminent biochemist named Melvin Calvin who was present, who found out while the meeting was taking place that he had won the Nobel Prize in chemistry that year, so for his work in photosynthesis. In any case, the agenda for the meeting was left to Frank Drake to put together. And Frank felt that the best way to think about the scientific merits for conducting SETI experiments was to ask the question, first of all, you know, well, are there other technological civilizations that might be in our own galaxy? And if so, you know, how many might there be? And how would we even think about addressing a question like that? But he felt that that was, you know, the underlying essence of the legitimacy of SETI would be the existence or not of other technological civilizations. And so he felt that the meeting should start by trying to figure out a number or an estimate or a way of thinking about N, where N is the number of technological civilizations that might exist elsewhere in our galaxy. And he surmised that if N was a large number, obviously there was a pretty compelling argument to be made for doing SETI research. And if N was an exceptionally small number, then maybe it wasn't a logical pursuit to undertake. So, well, what kind of questions do you then need to ask if you're going to figure out what N is? So he felt that it all starts, you know, with stars, which are the energy source and, as we now know, but didn't know at the time, also the origins source for planets themselves. And so he felt that the first question we needed to ask is, what is the birth rate of stars and what is their life cycle, essentially? He then thought that the next obvious question was, well, okay, once we understand stars and their life cycle, how many stars have planets around them? Are planets rare? Are they common? At the time, in 1961, we didn't know the answer to that question, but it was an obviously important one to this estimation of N. And then he thought, well, you know, if there are planets, some subset of those planets may be habitable. They might be like Earth, around the right size and configuration with a rocky surface and the right distance from their host star, where the conditions for supporting theoretically at least liquid water, which is quite abundant in the universe, as we now know, would exist. And therefore, you know, these habitable environments might be suitable for life to take place. Then he felt that the next question is, well, okay, if there are suitable habitable environments, Earth-like planets, what fraction of those actually go on to develop life? Next question, if life happens, in how many cases does evolution have enough time to take place such that complex organisms and ultimately intelligent species can emerge? And if intelligence emerges on a planetary system, in how many cases might there be enough time and the right conditions for a technologically advanced civilization to emerge from that set of intelligent species? And then lastly, he thought, well, if a technological civilization comes into existence and starts making its presence known, either intentionally or unintentionally, beyond its confines, how long does such a civilization remain detectable before the lights go out, if you will? And that could be either because the civilization goes extinct for reasons beyond their control, like an asteroid impact or extreme volcanic activity, or potentially for reasons of their own making, such as, you know, nuclear holocaust or pandemic or climate change. And obviously, I think he was looking at humanity at the time and our own challenges, many of which he arose as technology arose.
Yeah, this is the height of the Cold War.
It's the height of the Cold War.
Very worried about nuclear war.
Exactly. I think at that time, probably nuclear war was higher on our consciousness than climate change. But needless to say, people then and certainly now were thinking about, you know, various existential threats. But of course, there was also the possibility that a sufficiently advanced civilization that solves its problems, and including resource management and energy production and, you know, population and nuclear non-proliferation, let's say, that they might evolve into a being that no longer uses technologies we could detect, or even technologies at all, that maybe, you know, the ultimate evolutionary step is a civilization so advanced they might be indistinguishable from nature. So in any case, he felt that there was only a window of time that could be, you know, hundreds of years or thousands or maybe many tens of thousands, where a technological civilization might be able to be detected by another such civilization. And he realized that all of these questions could be represented with variables and sort of put together in a formula where basically the number of technological civilizations as an estimate would be the product of multiplying all of these factors together. And so he came up with this formula where N is the number of technologically advanced civilization equals R sub star, which is the birth rate and life cycle of stars, times F sub P, what fraction of stars have planets, times N sub E, how many of those planets are Earth-like, potentially habitable zone environments, times F sub L, what fraction of those habitable environments go on to develop life, times F sub I, what fraction of those where life emerges go on to develop intelligence, times F sub C, what fraction of intelligent life-bearing planets go on to have a species emerge that is technological, and lastly, times L, how long does a technological civilization remain detectable? And L, I think, was and is the most provocative and interesting and perhaps the most important.
And Bill Diamond, the president and CEO of the SETI Institute, and I are now joined by research scientist Uma Gorti, and we're going to talk about the first term in the Drake equation after N equals. Bill, what is it?
Well, that first term is R sub star or R star, and it refers to the birth rate of stars. These are the host energy source and the source of the birth of planetary systems. And so we should understand something about the life cycle of a star and how long stars live and last, et cetera. And that he captured with the variable R sub star.
And Uma, tell us about what you do at the SETI Institute.
So I'm a researcher. I'm a theorist. So I study how stars and planets form. So it turns out that they form simultaneously. The planets form at the same time as the stars do. And it's actually a very rapid process because it occurs because of a gravitational collapse. And this is, you know, just basically free fall. And so this happens very early on. And it happens in very obscured environments. So that's sort of one of the reasons why we know less about this process than we would like. And I'd sort of mostly concoct theories. I sort of try and understand the physical processes, try to explain what we see and what sort of conditions lead to the formation of stars and planets. And I mostly study these objects called disks. They're called, initially they form the stars, so they're called protostellar disks, and later on they form planets, so they're called protoplanetary disks, depending on which state of evolution the system is in. And I mostly study how material gets transported through the disk, forms the star, what's left behind, and how that forms planets.
I'm curious about the term R, that a lot of times when we think of the Drake equation, a lot of us think, well, it has to do with the number of stars in the Milky Way galaxy, but it's R, the rate of star formation. Why is that useful?
Yeah, so this is the rate, and so it's really the number of stars that form per year. So the very last term in the Drake equation is the length of time over which communication is possible, right? And that's typically much smaller. So let's say if you look at, you know, how long it took for civilization to rise on Earth, and then how long communication has been possible, is really a tiny fraction. The star formation process itself takes place over millions of years. So it makes sense to actually look at the shortest time scale at that end, because stars themselves live for billions of years. But so it's really the rate at which stars form, and then there is the time, that is the length over which communication is possible at the end, which then makes it sort of a number, right? So it's sort of how fast can you form stars and how many stars are you forming? And it turns out this is actually not a very efficient process in the galaxy. So if you take all the molecular clouds which collapse to form stars, it's typically a few percent that gets converted. And so over the whole galaxy, but it's roughly a range of about 1 to 5 solar masses, that's like the mass of the sun, per year. And we're talking about a galaxy that is, you know, something like 10 billion in terms of the mass that it has, that can potentially form stars. So you can see that this is really not, even if star formation process takes a million years, this is really still very inefficient.
Bill, anything you want to ask Grad?
Yeah, so Uma, I think by implication, stellar formation and planetary formation are concurrent, which means that there's kind of a one-to-one correspondence between the formation of planets, for example, the birth rate of mm-hmm. planets and the birth rate of star systems. And how long does it take in the process of planetary formation in these protoplanetary disks mm-hmm. for a solar system to form that we might recognize as a solar system? In other words, material that's ejected from the during the formation of the star begins to accrete and form planets. How much do we know about the time frame involved in that process?
Yes, observationally, so this is interesting because this is one of the first problems I worked on, which is the dispersal and the lifetime of these disks. Because once the disks are gone, everything is done. Because you really need gas to stick around to sort of mediate these collisions which take place, which eventually form planetesimals and planetary objects. And so the lifetime or how long you have to form planetary systems is really dictated by how long gas is present, so which is basically initially it's the dominant component. So we don't see it in our solar system except in Jupiter, for example. But the solids that really form planetary systems are initially just about 1% of the total mass. So most of it is actually in the form of hydrogen. In our solar system, all the hydrogen is in the sun, obviously. Mm-hmm. But the disk is, strangely enough, the disk is actually initially the most massive thing because it collects material and forms the star. So you know, there are, at the very early stages, the disk is more massive than the star itself. But mm-hmm. once the star forms, it puts out all this energy, it becomes bright, it becomes luminous, and then it puts out these powerful outflows. At least for solar-type stars, there's a lot of convection that goes on, so there's magnetic fields, which means that it is very bright in X-rays and in UV. And this high-energy radiation then heats the surface of the disk and eventually just disperses all the material away. So it's the star itself that gets rid of the disk eventually. And that sort of sets a time scale. So the first half, you are building the star in the center. And once you've built, you know, accumulated enough mass at the center to build the star then puts out all this energy that then just rips the disk apart or blows it away. And that is really not just blowing away. It's more like a gradual thermal or magnetic winds that cause this. But there are lots mm-hmm. of details in these processes that are still not very well understood. So to get back to your question, the time scale is about, let's say, we think between 5 to 10 million years. So that's sort of what we think the time scale is, because by that time, observationally, at least, you don't see anything. So if you go to objects that are more than 10 million years old, you find that all the disks are gone. So which means planet formation must have been complete by that time.
Well, Uma Gorti, research scientist at the SETI Institute, thanks for sharing your expertise on the rate of star formation, that part of the Drake equation, with us.
Thank you.
Thanks to our guest, SETI astrophysicist Uma Gorti. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our exploration of the Drake equation, which was created in 1961 by radio astronomer Frank Drake in order to create parameters for a scientific search for extraterrestrial civilizations. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back. If you're just joining us, we're exploring the state of the Drake equation in 2024 with our special co-host, Bill Diamond, president and CEO of the SETI Institute. The Drake equation, written in 1961, is a tool for trying to get at one of the greatest questions of all time: are we alone in the universe? Bill and I are joined now by the SETI Institute's Doug Caldwell to talk about the second term in the Drake equation. As a scientist who has worked on the greatest discoverer of exoplanets ever, the Kepler Space Telescope, he's uniquely qualified to talk about the fraction of stars that have planets. Doug Caldwell, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, Bill, it's quite amazing to think that we went from in 1961 thinking there were nine known planets, and conjecture that there might be out there, should be, maybe, but not knowing, to now we know of thousands that we know of for sure. And then, Bill, the statistical implications of that are?
The statistical implications are that essentially every star in the sky has one or more planets, which is based on the fact that, you know, we looked at a couple of 100,000 stars with Kepler. Doug will explain that in more detail, but the probability of orbits of these planets being in our line of sight with their host star is, you know, less than 1% likely. And so when Kepler found thousands of stars and you do the math backwards, it turns out, well, that statistically they all do.
Well, Doug, Bill's very fond of saying Kepler is the greatest NASA science mission of all time that's not that well known. And he's right. It's just incredible, you know, what a game changer in terms of figuring out that there are so many exoplanets out there. Could you just briefly tell us about a little bit of the background of when Kepler launched and, you know, its duration of its mission and how it works?
Sure. In the 1960s, we didn't know about planets around other stars. Even in the early 1990s, we still didn't know. The first planets around another star were discovered in the early 1990s, and they were around a pulsar, which is a dead star that's gone supernova, so not likely places to find life. The first planet around a star, kind of like the sun, was found in 1995, and it was found by measuring the motion back and forth of the star as the planet orbited around it. And there were a number of planets that were found this way, but it required looking at each star individually for a long time to carefully measure this motion. The Kepler mission was an idea of what if we could look at a bunch of stars at once and try and get a better statistical handle on how many planets are out there. And in fact, Kepler's goal was to find out how many planets, like about the size of the Earth and in orbits where they might be at the right temperature for liquid water, are out there. And so Kepler was first proposed in, I think, 1992, which was before planets were found around other stars. It was rejected. It was proposed again and rejected again, et cetera. The fifth time was a charm, and Kepler was actually accepted by NASA as a mission. I think it was officially in 2000. And the idea behind Kepler was we're going to stare at one spot in the sky for 4 years or hopefully more and look for these occurrences where not the motion of the star, but if a planet happens to pass in front of that star, it'll block part of the starlight because it's dark. And we can measure that dimming of the star. And then when the planet orbits around its star and passes in front of it again, we see another dip. And so we see these periodic dips that tell us the year in that planet's orbit, how long it takes the planet to go around its star. And that gives us an idea of how far it is from its star. The amount of dimming the star undergoes tells us how big the planet is relative to the star. And so Kepler was this kind of a weird idea at the time because no planets had been discovered by this method yet. And it was proposing to build a satellite, launch it into space, to do this large survey. And there was a lot of pushback by a lot of people, but eventually we demonstrated that it was a feasible technology. You could do this. And Kepler was launched after some delays due to the typical things like in NASA with funding delays. It was launched in 2009. And it observed for almost exactly 4 years before it lost the second of its reaction wheels, which are essentially these gyroscopes that allowed it to point very precisely at the stars that we were staring at. And so that ended the prime mission of Kepler. But we got 4 years of data, which was enough to see basically like four of these dimmings, or we call them transits, of a planet in a one-year orbit, which is what the real goal was.
And it was looking at a really cool part of the sky. If anybody's familiar with the summer Milky Way, you've been out camping and looked up in the sky, the constellation Cygnus, the swan, you know, is kind of flying south through the Milky Way, as it were. It's just a beautiful part of the sky. Why was that chosen?
It was chosen, since we wanted to do a survey, we wanted a lot of stars. And originally thought, oh, we'll look in the plane of the Milky Way. There's tons of stars there. But with some more analysis and thinking about it, we realized, oh, wait, there's actually too many stars there. And each star that we're looking at with our telescope will have a bunch of other stars right next to it. And that'll cause difficulty in figuring out where our signal was coming from. So we did some studies, analysis, and figured out if we look instead of directly in the plane of the Milky Way, we move up a little bit. So from Cygnus, we move up towards Vega. We get a lot of stars because we're near the plane, but not too many. And that was sort of a sweet spot that was chosen to give us that. We also had constraints on, since we wanted to stare for 4 years straight without looking away, we wanted a place where the sun wasn't going to get in the way, or the earth wasn't going to get in the way. So we wanted to look up out of the ecliptic plane. And that limits the regions where you're close to the Milky Way, but not in it and not in near the ecliptic plane. And so that was Cygnus was chosen as our sweet spot for that.
The ecliptic plane being the, basically the plane of the solar system that the planets orbit in around the sun.
Yes.
Okay, so now that the mission's basically over, how many exoplanets, confirmed exoplanets, are there from the Kepler survey?
So Kepler looked at about 170,000 stars continuously. Some dropped on and off the list, but about 170,000 stars for 4 years. And we found over 3,000 confirmed planets from that survey, and an additional probably about 3,000 what we call planet candidates, which are likely to be planets, but we just haven't been able to go through the rigorous process of confirming each of them. So Kepler increased the number of known planets by orders of magnitude. It was amazingly successful, and it really answered the questions it set out to answer, which was, as Bill mentioned earlier, by seeing this many planets, we know that essentially every star has at least one planet, possibly more. So there's more planets than stars in our sky, in our Milky Way. And of those planets, most of them are small, which are the sort of interesting things, interesting ones now that we think of as possible sites for life.
Possibly analogs to Earth.
Yeah. Now, Kepler was the survey, and it basically detected the presence, size, and orbital period of the planet, and no other features of the planet. And so we've been trying to scrupulously avoid the term Earth-like when talking about Kepler's detections, because we really don't have any idea what that planet is like from the Kepler data. Mm-hmm. We just see, okay, there's a planet, it's about the size of the Earth, and it's in a one-year orbit around the star like the sun. And that's all we know.
Bill, anything you want to ask there?
Yeah, so I think one of the interesting things as well, and the incredible things about the Kepler mission was the sensitivity. And I think, you know, part of the reason why NASA rejected the proposal a few times was they just didn't believe the technology would work. But it's important to appreciate that the field of view was a couple of 100,000 stars. So from the telescope's point of view, they were still just points of light. You know, it's not like this was a watching a planet transit across our sun, which is something quite easy to observe. And so an Earth-like planet transiting a sun-like star observed from that distance would just dim the light by about one part in 10,000, if I'm not mistaken, and Doug will correct me if I am, but in any case, a very, very small amount of dimming. And yet the instruments on Kepler were capable of making that observation, making that measurement, and allowing us for the first time to see, in fact, that the smaller kind of Earth size plus minus planets were, in fact, the most abundant.
Yeah, that's a very good point, Bill. The real key to Kepler's success was its extreme precision in measuring the brightness of these stars. For the most of the planets that had been found to this up to this point when Kepler launched were larger, like the size of Jupiter. And if Jupiter goes in front of our sun, it blocks about 1% of the light. It's about 1% the area of the sun. In Kepler, we measured our precision in parts per million, and Earth going in front of the sun is 84 parts per million. Jupiter going in front of the sun at 1% is 10,000 parts per million. So we were looking for a much, much smaller signal. The Earth is a lot smaller than Jupiter. And so we had to stare at these stars, but also very carefully measure the brightness of the stars and remove all the instrumental effects. And that was in part what I was, along with a lot of other people, was responsible for. I was the instrument scientist for Kepler. So my job was really trying to understand how the instrument was affecting the data we were taking, and were the signals in the data we're seeing real and coming from the stars, or were they coming from the instrument? And so it was a lot of work going from collecting these images to getting this final catalog. But that work really paid off in the sense that it gave us a lot of confidence that our results we were getting were real and believable.
And you are also involved, Doug, with a follow-up mission called TESS, the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite. Tell us a bit about, you know, what's going on with that.
Okay, yeah. So Kepler, as we mentioned, was a survey. Are there planets out there? And the answer was yes. TESS is more of a directed mission that's trying to find, okay, we know they're out there, let's find our nearest neighbors. So it's doing a survey of basically the entire sky. It's done it, I think, four times now, and it's still going. And it's looking for stars nearby. Do they have planets? And if so, how big are they? What are their orbital periods? And its original goal was to find targets for James Webb Space Telescope, which can look at these nearby planets. So TESS is using the same method as Kepler. It's looking for transits, but it's looking at all the nearby stars, whereas most of Kepler's stars were further away in the Milky Way, making it harder for follow-up to do because they're just fainter stars. So TESS has been very successful. Its prime mission goal was to find 50 small planets for James Webb. It's found over 100 and is still turning up more. It's doing a lot of other science. It's been able to add a lot of insight into supernova studies because it's observing continuously. Also, it'll catch a supernova before we know it went off on Earth. And then you can actually look back and say, oh, it was observing the star before the supernova went off. So you can see light curves very early on. So it's doing a lot of other science. Just one example. But it's also finding many, many planet candidates. And to date, I think it's found something like 6,000 candidates. And it's really swamping our ability to confirm these planets. And so it has a smaller fraction of confirmed planets coming out of it just because there's too much work to do because it's being so successful.
Kind of a nice problem to have, really. Yeah. Finding too many planets. Okay. Well, Doug Caldwell, thanks for sharing your expertise with us about the Kepler mission and TESS and helping us get a handle on F sub P.
Cool. Thanks for talking.
Thanks to Doug Caldwell, SETI Institute research scientist and a member of the Kepler Space Telescope science team. Now, Bill Diamond and I turn our attention to two very important and interesting terms of the Drake equation, the number of planets capable of sustaining life and the number of planets on which life has actually arisen. Our guest for these terms is Natalie Cabral. Natalie is the director of the Carl Sagan Center for the Study of Life in the Universe at the SETI Institute, and she joins us now. Natalie Cabral, welcome once again to Blue Dot.
Hi, how are you?
Great. It's great to have you back again. All right. Well, Bill, let's let you lead off. Tell us what this term is, N sub E.
N sub E is an effort to understand or to rather attempt to quantify what percentage of exoplanets that exist, which is captured by the variable F sub L, what percentage of planets might be rocky Earth-like planets in the habitable zone of their host star? In other words, a distance from their host star such that, in principle, liquid water could be present on the surface based on surface temperature and other conditions. So this is an effort to take us one step further from the step of how many stars have planets captured by F sub L to how many of those planets are potentially habitable. Doesn't mean they are for sure, nor does it yet mean they have life on them, but it means that at least the conditions in principle exist for life to emerge.
And Natalie, you're a planetary scientist who has been dealing with the question of life beyond Earth for your career and a stellar career it's been. Planetary and stellar. Natalie, what would be your take on how N sub E has evolved in the time that you've been working on this problem?
It's been 20 years now, really, since we have a good idea of the quantification of this term. Basically, it started with us learning that habitability is not only about the habitable zone, which is that, you know, range of distances between the planet and the star, as I was mentioning, where liquid water can stay at the surface. So in addition to the habitable zone, now we have this other notion, which is that of habitable environment. And that means that you still can have all that is necessary for life, that is energy, water, nutrients, a source of carbon and shelters, but not being within the habitable zone. And so that's the reason why today we are so hopeful, in fact, that life appear in the solar system, say, for, you know, on Europa or Enceladus or even Titan, they are way outside of the habitable zone, but they have all of these ingredients that life requires. to be present. So this is what happened in the past 20, 30 years. I mean, maybe a little longer, because we started investigating extreme environments on Earth in the 70s. Now, the number of exoplanet and the number of planetary systems that we've discovered in the past 20 years is changing, obviously, this parameter quite a bit. Now we have a better idea how to quantify this number when we look up at the sky.
It's interesting because, you know, when you think about this term, in the word is planets, the number of planets around stars that could be in the habitable zone. I like using the term that Carl Sagan did, worlds, because as you mentioned, Enceladus and Titan and Europa are places where we may find life. They're not planets, but they're moons of planets, but they're worlds. And it's an interesting kind of a paradigm shift, don't you think?
I do agree. I found it a lot easier to use because if in a smaller scale, you can advocate that we are finding more and more of all of the ingredients for life in comets and asteroids. We have found everything that is necessary to make life as we know it in those little, and they are not even worlds. They are, you know, bricks of worlds, or, you know, name it what you want. But to go back to the number of planets or world that could harbor life, you know, this is such an amazing time. You look at what Kepler did. And if we are just looking at the math, this is mind-boggling. Right now, let's say that if we are taking all these numbers, there could be 300 million worlds right now that could be, you know, habitable just in, you know, in our galaxy. What does that say? Well, in fact, that doesn't say much, because we are here with an incredible number of possibilities. And these are just for planets. As you mentioned, there are moons and other things that can come up and, you know, grow that number. On the other hand, we also realize by studying those planetary systems, exoplanetary systems, that, well, it seems that planets kind of move in their lives. And what we see right now in the sky is just a snapshot in time, you know, in space and time. And so it may be that many of those planets didn't form where we observe them today. So they might be in the habitable zone now, but that doesn't say that they formed there. And they might be or too dry or too, you know, I don't know what, and maybe in the habitable zone and not being, in fact, habitable at all. But on the other hand, they are things that we were not expecting at all, such as rogue planets, which might be habitable. I mean, those planets are wandering in space without a star. We have stars that we never would have imagined could have planetary system. In fact, the only stellar type we didn't find a planetary system around right now is a type O, which are the biggest, most luminous stars. Everything else we found a planetary system around.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, my special co-host Bill Diamond and I will continue our examination of the Drake Equation in 2024 with our guest, planetary scientist and director of the Carl Sagan Center for the Study of Life in the Universe, Natalie Cabral. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our examination of the Drake Equation, designed to organize the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. My special co-host is Bill Diamond, president and CEO of the SETI Institute, and our guest is Natalie Cabral, director of the SETI Institute's Carl Sagan Center for the Study of Life in the Universe. Well, Bill, while we have Natalie with us, let's transition to the next term in the Drake Equation, F sub L. Explain what F sub L is briefly for us.
Well, F sub L is, we start now with planetary environments or worlds, as we just discussed, which are potentially habitable. F sub L tries to capture the fraction of those worlds in which life may indeed have emerged. So we've got a habitable environment. It doesn't mean that life has taken hold in these environments. But in the case of F sub L, now we're saying some subset of these habitable worlds, habitable environments, should have life taking shape or taking hold or emerging. And that's what F sub L attempts to capture.
Well, Natalie, you've worked on this problem quite extensively, especially like with the planet Mars, where NASA has all of these rover missions we've been looking at, trying to find out, is there evidence for past life on Mars? I would like to know, what's your take on, as a scientist, how we try to get at this problem of what is the fraction of these worlds that do, where life does arise?
I'm going to tell you what that fraction is right now. It's one. This is the only one that we know of. Mm-hmm. And we have this incredible potential in front of us. But truth is that our space exploration is young, and we have spent most of the past decades characterizing habitability, which is in fact trying to give a more quantitative response to F sub E. Now, when it comes to life, we are just doing this now. We are transitioning from missions that we are looking for habitability to missions that are looking for life. So at this point in time, the number is still one. We are still the only data set. But having said that, there is lots of potential. As we mentioned, for the habitability and the potential for life, you have the habitable zone and you have the habitable environment. And as you start from Mars, and Mars is still at the limit of the habitable zone, by the way, you are starting to think more in terms of microbial life. Obviously, there is no advanced civilization in the solar system, but there are many places in the solar system where we do have the ingredients for life. On Mars, if we want to, find life, it will have to be underground because it cannot survive at the surface. And it will have to be microbial and simple just because Mars doesn't have the energy or the nutrients to shelter a more advanced life. That's not the same with Europa. Europa, like Enceladus, not only is active, not only we can think about finding life there, but on Europa, you also have a little bit more oxygen, and which means that we could have a little bit of a more complex life there. And we can go on and with Titan, et cetera. Titan is really cool because, well, literally, but because we might have a chance to find life as we don't know it with liquid methane and ethane. But we also have a water ocean under the surface of Titan. So what can happen there? Nobody knows. But the bigger question is not that. The bigger question is that we have started looking for life beyond Earth, and we don't have a good definition for life. We have working definitions for life. In fact, we are looking at life beyond the Earth with a working definition, which is basically a chemical system capable of Darwinian evolution, which means that it's an autonomous chemical system that's capable of adapting to changes. And this is what we have. But you have many researchers, and I'm one of them, that say that that's not a definition, that's a description. Not anybody agrees with that. So it's very much a question mark. So how do you search for something you really do not know what it is? And I think this makes that search, extremely fascinating, because since we do have only one model of what life is, every single question that we are asking when we are looking for life elsewhere is a question that reflects, an interrogation about ourselves and our place in the solar system and our place in the universe. So as we are, in fact, trying to document N sub L, we are learning a lot more about ourselves.
Yeah, one of the other interesting things about F sub L in my lifetime and yours is how we've come to view all these interesting places where we never would have thought life existed, like the deep sea ocean vents around the mid-ocean ridges, where you have chemosynthesis instead of photosynthesis going on. Extremophiles living in, you know, geothermal areas like in Lassen Volcanic National Park, where I know you've been, and Yellowstone, places like that. So it's just, it's interesting that life seems to find a way in these very extreme environments on Earth, at least.
It is, and I think, you know, I've said more than once that apparently the hardest, and we will have to revisit that too, but the hardest is to get life started, because when it started, there is nothing that seemed to be able to stop it. Even if you think that you are stopping, you know, one type of life, something else is going to show up. And so that goes back to the nature of life, you know, more than the origin of life. What is really life? What is it? I think that we'll find those answers more in the universal laws of nature. And, right now there are some biophysical models that are taking us in that direction. And if you look at them, they are telling you that, well, life is the inevitable result of thermodynamics. So if that's the case, we are looking for a lot of life out there.
Natalie, I'm wondering what kind of tools you have and are going to have at your disposal here in the near future that really excite you, perhaps thinking about the James Webb Space Telescope and things like that. What are some of the tools that excite you to as a scientist delving into this question?
You know, definitely James Webb. And not only James Webb, remember that I'd say that maybe in a decade from now with the huge ground-based telescopes, some of them will be more powerful than some of the space telescopes. So we are capable today of looking for alien worlds through spectroscopy, interrogate their atmosphere, trying to figure out if there is any signature out there in their atmosphere that cannot be produced only by the environment. So this is really exciting. We are already starting to find some interesting molecules, you know. Unfortunately, they're all ambiguous, methane, oxygen, etc. The signature of life alone. It would be really, really intriguing to start finding things that are synthetic, for instance, you know, or can only be produced by alien pollution. But spectroscopy is one that is really interesting. But I'm looking now at, you know, how to best use artificial intelligence, because we can process so much data. But then artificial intelligence is great at recognizing patterns and things like that. And life has patterns. And this is something that I've been documenting over and over in extreme environments. And now we are trying to teach algorithm to recognize those patterns. And I'm really excited about that in many respects, because life and the environment co-evolve. When life emerges on a planet, you cannot talk anymore about life and environment. It's some sort of an hybrid. I would push the envelope by saying that, you know, when life emerges on the planet, this becomes a living planet, because its composition, its texture, its atmosphere, etc., everything is going to be changed. Very people know that 30% of all minerals on Earth wouldn't exist if life had not been there, for instance. So there is this notion of changes of a planet by life, and this notion is encompassed in the term complexity. So complexity is actually a complex term, because life can make the environment simpler or more complicated. We still need to grasp that. We still need to understand how to go after the signature of coevolution, which is really what I am excited about, because I'm a little tired of hearing, you know, we are looking for life, or we are looking for something that is only environment. If you have life somewhere, well, sorry, you don't have environment and life. You have this living planet, and complexity is the key. Maybe thermodynamics, how, you know, energy and information are being shared. These are the stuff This is the kind of stuff that really excites me right now.
That's fascinating. And Bill, do you feel like we've covered these two terms to your satisfaction?
Yes, absolutely. I think the idea that life can impart patterns or signatures in its environment that we might be able to detect also from great distances beyond our solar system, you know, just adds another tool to the toolbox, another, I think, level of opportunity and excitement for this endeavor. So it's really an extraordinary time.
Well, Natalie Cabral, director of the Carl Sagan Center for the Study of Life in the Universe there at the SETI Institute, thanks for joining Bill and I to talk about these two parts of the Drake equation in 2024. It's always lovely to talk to you.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks again to all our guests, SETI Institute scientists Uma Gorti, Doug Caldwell, and Natalie Cabral. And special thanks to my co-host, Bill Diamond, President and CEO of the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California. Be sure to tune in next time as Bill and I conclude our two-part look at the state of the Drake equation in 2024, which includes some of the most fascinating and tantalizing terms in the equation designed by radio astronomer Frank Drake 63 years ago to organize the scientific quest to determine one of the great mysteries of all time, are we alone in the universe? You won't want to miss that. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Cap Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. The theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.